Thanks a lot. So before I begin, I should thank my former postdoc, David Poulin, who did some of this work with me when he was with us at the University of Queensland a couple of years ago. He then moved to Caltech and is now at Sherbrooke. Okay, so we've seen a number of talks now which skirt around this tricky issue of what time is precisely. But I'll just take a fairly naive view of this for the moment and just say time is what clocks measure. Bill Unruh said this morning is, clocks measure something and they measure time. But this is not quite the obvious and facile answer that it first appears. And when you start thinking about the sorts of very diverse physical systems that we actually use as clocks, you begin to realize that simply saying what clocks measure is not a simple thing at all. For example, what about this guy? This is the skull of a Kennewick man who has been keeping a team of lawyers busy 9,000 years after he died. And the question is, where was the clock to tell us that? So far as we know, they didn't have watches back then. And there was no sort of ticking watch in the site when he was dug up. But of course, we know that this date, 9,000 years, is based on radioactive decay. So this is indeed a kind of clock. It's a clock with no tock. It just ticks. An atom decays or not. And you just count the number that haven't decayed or are still there after some period, and backing out if you use your knowledge of the particular radionuclides involved, you can then estimate how much time has elapsed since Kennewick Man died. And this is a perfectly good clock. It's statistical, but as I'll show in a minute, all our clocks have some statistical character to them. And Sam Brownstein and I actually wrote a paper on how to do time estimation with clocks like this some years ago. We wanted to title the paper, The Clock with No Tock, but the style mavens at PhysRev, of course, weren't having any of that. Now, the tockless clock. And here's another kind of clock, of course, cosmological clocks, and that raises some interesting questions about what precisely do we mean when we say the universe is 13.75 billion years old, give or take a bit. Okay, so there are fairly diverse physical systems that we use to estimate time. But of course, all our time standards that we use to coordinate the internet and flight schedules, however badly, are based on atomic clocks sitting in NIST and other places around the world. And so let's just look at those in a little bit more detail. First of all, they're based upon quantum mechanical changes in the state of electronic motion in a particular type of atom. And we know how quantum mechanics describes the changes of systems as time progresses, or as you translate them in space, or as you translate them in time. It's given by these fairly simple rules, so-called Schrödinger rules, which, if you like, are basically what's embodied in the Schrödinger equation, but here written explicitly as unitary transformations. These are one-parameter unitary transformations, or you can write them in differential form. But the key point to note here, at least from the point of view of this talk, is that the x and t that appear in those equations are classical parameters. They're not operators at this level of description. And of course, it's our objective in building a clock to make measurements upon systems that have been translated in this way and estimate, as best we can, these classical parameters x and t. So let me just give an example of how you do that, just so I can point out quite clearly how statistical is this kind of clock. How does NIST make a clock? Well, the basic idea is no good preparing a system in some energy eigenstate. It won't evolve at all. So the very next best thing you can do is prepare it in a superposition of two energy eigenstates, and here I've just taken an equal superposition. And then, of course, applying the Schrödinger rules for translation in time. Each of those amplitudes evolves at a different rate because the energies are different. So there's a relative phase accumulated between them that depends on the energy separation. In actual fact, of course, because this is not an energy eigenstate, there's some non-zero variance for the energy. And in this very simple case, the variance in the energy just basically scales as a square of the difference between the two energies in the superimposed states. So that's the state at time t. The question is now, how do you go in and estimate that parameter T. Well, there's no good going in and measuring whether or not it has energy E1 or energy E2, because that hasn't changed. That's still 50-50. It hasn't changed from the original state that we began, that we prepared the system in. You have to measure something that is off-diagonal in the energy basis. So here what I'm going to do is imagine we measure this projection operator, which projects onto, in this particular case, this even superposition of the energy eigenstates. In other words, it's simply asking, what's the probability that the system is in the initial state that I started in? Well, you can easily work out that this is a projection operator, so it only has measurement results 0 and 1. That's what you measure. You don't measure a probability. Nobody measures a probability directly. But here you measure in a large number of trials. Sometimes you get 0, sometimes you get 1. And on the basis of that, you try and estimate a probability. But we know in quantum mechanics what the probability for getting 0 and 1 actually are. They're given by these expressions here. And it oscillates at a rate that depends upon delta. That is, it'll oscillate faster and faster if I superimpose states of very different energy. Now, there's a fairly simple theory that tells you what the uncertainty is. The optimal uncertainty is no matter how you go about this particular measurement. And it turns out the uncertainty in the estimated parameter T, after you've sampled this particular distribution in many, many trials, is bounded below by 1 on delta squared. So because that is basically the variance in the energy in the initial state, we get this fairly simple idea that we can estimate the time parameter, this classical parameter T, extremely well by sampling these distributions, so long as the variance in the initial state was very large. So as long as these two states are well separated in energy, we can get a very good estimate of T. Okay, exactly the same thing applies for spatial translations. In that case, I'm not going to go through the argument, but we superimpose states of definite momentum, and then we measure in something that's not diagonal in the measurement basis, for example, position. And basically, you can see how this would work as a quantum ruler by setting up some sort of interference grating, which is what you'd get if you superimpose two states of different momenta for a free particle. Okay, so you can see from there that our very best clocks, the clocks on which all our time standards are based, at their core involve some uncertainty, some sampling of a quantum mechanical probability distribution. And this, of course, leads directly to these parameter-based uncertainty relations that I've just given you one example of. If you want to see more details on this, you can look at this paper that I wrote together with Carl Caves and Sam Brownstein some years ago. And I'll come back to this at the end to discuss Lorentz invariant uncertainty principles, because they can easily be backed out of this formalism as well. Okay, so the central lesson there is if we want to estimate a time parameter in a quantum mechanical universe, you are necessarily forced to try and sample probability distributions by making repeated measurements on identically prepared systems that have been translated in time or translated in space. But what about cosmological time in a cosmological setting? Well, we know, of course, that because general relativity is generally covariant or diffeomorphism invariant, that in some sense the time parameter isn't real. It's just a coordinate in the system. And we've already heard a number of aspects of the difficulties that arise because of this particular feature. Let me go back to this early work by Bill Unruh, and other work by Page and Wouters many years ago. The essential idea, because of this notion of general covariance, is that the universe itself should be in some stationary state. In intuitive terms, what this is really saying is that if we have the state of the whole universe, there's no phase reference with which we can talk about its time evolution. There's no other system which we can compare it to and get some relative phase for its evolution. So this state shouldn't depend on coordinate time, so it should be some sort of energy eigenstate for the entire state of the universe. In the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, it's some sort of zero energy eigenstate. More generally, of course, it could be some arbitrary mixture of energy eigenstates. If one took a kind of Bayesian perspective, and you don't know what this value of energy actually is. Oh, standard mobile phone problem. Let me put that down there. It's a BlackBerry, notice. So in this case, we could take an arbitrary mixture of these energy eigenstates. And of course, that also is a stationary state. It doesn't have any dependence on coordinate time. So where is time in this picture? How do we back out some notion of time? Well, one way to do it is just to introduce this unphysical coordinate time through a trick, which is sometimes called group averaging. And that is to notice that that particular diagonal mixed state that I wrote down in the energy basis can easily be obtained just by time averaging the evolution of an arbitrary state over some sufficiently long period of time. Because all the off-diagonal components coming from different energy eigenvalues in the Brough and the Keck component of this will average to zero, and you'll only pick up the diagonal components. Of course, then this particular probability distribution depends on what state I choose here. But the whole point behind this particular argument, it doesn't actually matter what that probability distribution is back here. All that matters is it's in some stationary state. Now, this, of course, has a strong connection to recent work in quantum information theory in the notion of reference frames and superselection rules. And there's this very nice paper by Steve Bartlett, Terry Rudolph, and Rob Speckens, but I'm hoping that Steve, wherever he is, will be saying something about this afternoon. Okay, so I'm not going to say anything more about that. What I want to do, instead of going through the general formalism, is just to take a very specific example, the simplest example that, well, at least fairly simple example that I could think of to illustrate some of the principles that are involved here. So I'm going to spend a few minutes talking about this universe that's simply composed of two harmonic oscillators. This is the two-spring universe. So the Hamiltonian for such a universe is written in terms of the number operator for the number of excitations in each oscillator. And we'll let them have different frequencies, omega 1 and omega 2. An energy eigenstate of such a Hamiltonian is simply a tensor product state with n excitations in oscillator 1 and m excitations in oscillator 2. If these are optical modes, these would be interpreted as photons. If these were actual vibrational systems, these would be phonons. The total energy is then n times omega 1 and m times omega 2. I'm setting h bar equal to 1 in this particular example. So that is the state of total energy. It's convenient now to try and use dimensionless units for energy, so I'm going to divide everything through by omega 1. If I put h bar back in, that means dividing everything through by h bar omega 1 as a convenient energy scale. And then the total energy is simply given by this integer n plus some ratio of the two frequencies times another integer m. And we're going to assume, just for the sake of this example, that the ratio of these two frequencies is rational. In particular, just 1 over n, capital N. So capital N is something that defines, it's a parameter that helps to define this universe. It tells us something about this two-spring universe. That is, the ratio of their two frequencies is rational, and it's given by 1 on capital N. And then, of course, this rescaled energy is also given by an integer m. And just in terms of the frequencies, just to remind you, this means that one oscillator has a much higher frequency than the other one, because typically we're going to see that n needs to be pretty big. Okay. So we have these two numbers, n and m, that help to define the kind of universe that we're looking at. And these little integers that tell us which particular energy eigenstates that we're in are related to each other because we put a constraint on the total energy. If we constrain the total energy, then the number of excitations in each oscillator is not independent. They're tied together. So we can easily write down then an energy eigenstate as a superposition state of all the ways that we can have n excitations in oscillator 1, but still have the total energy determined by this parameter epsilon, or total n. So you see, we can do that by fixing big N, which fixes the frequency ratio of the two springs involved. And then we can sum over n up to m in this particular expression. So that's the superposition state. But as I argued before, we really should be in some sort of mixture of states with different values of capital M. So each, this is an eigenstate of total energy, and this is a mixture over all those different eigenstates of total energy. So that's the state of our two-spring universe. There's still no time in this picture at all. So let's take a closer look at that state. Quantum information theory people would immediately recognize it as an entangled state. It's an entangled state by specifying a correlation in terms of something like total photon number is fixed, or total energy is fixed in this particular case. But it's nearly always the case that when you write down some entangled state, which in this case is an eigenstate of total energy, there's always some other operator which commutes with that, for which it is either an eigenstate or a near eigenstate. In the case of qubits, these would be the stabilizers for the particular entangled state that we're looking at. But here it turns out that this particular state is also a near eigenstate of this phase difference operator. So there's some overall period, T1, which is determined by the frequency of oscillator 1, and then these phase operators. So let me just define what those phase operators are. There are various ways to do this, but for the purposes of this talk, I'm going to assume that they're defined by the Susskind-Glogower phase operator. And this, of course, strictly speaking, one shouldn't think of this as an operator, but rather as a projection-operated valued measure. And it turns out that this is the optimal projection-operated valued measure for phase estimation. Even though you may never actually be able to do it in practice with this level of accuracy, this will be the limit of some sequences of some real physical measurement process to try and estimate phase or phase difference. So we're going to imagine that on this state, rho, if we shift it by some phase theta, we then want to measure this phase phi using this Susskind-Glogower positive operator value measure. And on the basis of some particular value theta, assign a value, basis of some observed value phi, assign a value theta to this parameter that we're trying to estimate in this problem. So this is the phase estimation problem. It's very much like the time estimation problem. We prepare some initial state, we translate it in time, and we measure something on that state and try and back out how much time has elapsed. In this particular state, the Susskind-Glogower operator valued measure is a projection onto these totally unnormalized states. So you can see straight away that this can't correspond to any real physical measurement, but rather is intended to be the limit of some sequence of physical measurements. We can then, if we like, define a phase operator in terms of a spectral decomposition with respect to this positive operator value measure. But then if we take the Fourier transform of that thing, you get this operator P, which simply acts to displace states in the number basis, in the basis conjugate to the phase. So if you think of this as a harmonic oscillator, what this number P is now is it's a photon number displacement operator conjugate to the Susskind-Glogower phase. So what we imagine doing is we prepare our system in this state of definite energy, and we want to think about making phase measurements upon it to try and estimate the relative phase difference between the two components of this two-spring universe. Well, the joint phase distribution for such measurements can easily be written down because these are two distinct physical systems with two separate Hilbert spaces. So we can write down a joint distribution for the phase of oscillator 1 and the phase of oscillator 2, and it's given by a projection onto this tensor product projection operator value measure. And you can work that out for the state that I defined before, and this is what it is. And this turns out, if n is big and m is big, this turns out to be extremely sharply peaked at a particular value of phi 1 minus n phi 2. Remember, big N gives us the ratio of the two frequencies involved for these two oscillators. So in other words, this thing here is not only an actual energy eigenstate for this two-spring universe, it's actually a near eigenstate of this particular phase difference between the two oscillators. And this is a general feature. If I take a state of two oscillators, which is an eigenstate of number sum, it'll be a near eigenstate of phase difference. Conversely, if I take a state of two oscillators, which is a near eigenstate of number difference, it'll be, an exact eigenstate of number difference. It'll be a near eigenstate of phase sum in that case. Now, let's suppose on the basis of that distribution, we actually do some post-selection. We have some big data set of measurements of phi1, measurements of phi2, the joint distribution of which is described by this probability distribution. And then we go through and post-select on the basis of choosing only those elements in the data set for which phi1 is actually equal to 0. Well, what you're actually doing then is something like a Poincaré section. What you're really doing is saying, well, I'm only going to choose all those values for which the data set has phi1 equal to 0, and then record all the values of phi2 that correspond to that. In actual fact, that's just a Poincaré section of the energy surface of this double oscillator. To give you an idea of what that means, it's something like the following. An orbit of total energy classically will be evolving on some sort of torus in this phase space. It'll wrap around one way for one oscillator and one way for the other. And if we then take a section through phi1 equals 0, every time it goes around, it has a slightly different piercing of this section. And that's what corresponds to each of those different points sitting there. So there's no time in this picture as such yet, but we know in the sort of Poincaré picture, as I've just indicated, it's in there implicitly in the way I just gave that interpretation. So each piercing here corresponds to a distinct point around here. So that is already encoded in the basis of this joint phase distribution in the extremely tight correlation that obtains between phi1 minus n phi2 equals 2 pi some times some integer. But there's still no obvious time parameter, so let's see how we can back that out. So let's go back again to this idea of a group average, and this time I'll do it discretely because that's more appropriate to this particular discrete problem. So again, I will state that if we have some arbitrary state, pure state of this joint two oscillator system, we can very easily write this as a mixed state by doing this group averaging. Now, we want one of these systems to be a very good clock. This is the whole idea behind a relational approach to time. So we imagine that the photon number distribution, or the photon number distribution for oscillator number one, is extremely broad. That is, it doesn't have a well-defined energy, just in the way I described that NIST makes clocks. We want this state to be as far from an energy eigenstate as possible. And that will make a good clock. On the basis of that, we can now do a partial trace. We do the group averaging, and then just look at the phase distribution for oscillator 2, and you'll find that it's now actually a mixture over states that look like they're just unitarily evolved from the initial state for oscillator 2, plus some joint distribution, some conditional distribution that is averaged over this integer alpha. And this you can actually calculate for this problem. It again looks like some very sharply peaked phase distribution. So this is the key idea behind the way of backing out relational time in these systems from states of constant total energy, mixed states of constant total energy. But there's still no time yet, so let me go a little bit further. First of all, for a good clock, I said it will turn out that this thing here is extremely sharply peaked on the assumption that the energy variance in oscillator 1 is very large. And then, of course, you can just pick that particular point in the total sum here, just take out that term where this is sharply peaked, then make a simple change of variables from phase to omega 1 times t, and now straight away you'll recognize this is just what the unitary evolution would indeed be for oscillator 2. So now finally we see something like a coordinate time appearing. So on the basis of that, we can now very quickly try and generalize it. So let's suppose we step back from this particular model, and we imagine that all we need to do is specify this joint distribution over this group averaging parameter alpha. And here's one choice. I could make a Poisson distribution for this conditional distribution. And this will be very sharply peaked as long as that parameter gamma tilde is very large. A Poisson distribution has a variance that is equal to the mean, and if I make the mean of the distribution very, very large, the relative width of the distribution goes as 1 over the square root of the mean. Again, making this change of variable, going to, instead of phase, using omega times t, we can immediately write down a single differential equation for how the state of the system evolves according to this relational time coordinate t. And for this particular Poisson choice, you see now what we get is not the Schrodinger equation, but something very closely related to it. In fact, instead of getting a unitary representation of time translations in differential form, what you get is a unital semigroup representation. We expect this parameter gamma to be very big because we want that distribution to be very sharply peaked. And then you see, indeed, you pick up the Schrodinger term, but you pick up a correction term which destroys coherence in the energy basis. And this is a general feature of all these relational models, is because the clock is finite, it's a part of the overall system, there's some intrinsic level of decoherence that will necessarily be apparent when you look at the results of joint measurements on clock and the rest of the rest of the system. And I stress that there can be no interaction between the clock and the physical system, the actual system we're looking at. It's very bad to have a strong interaction between the clock and the actual system that you're trying to measure. So in the energy basis, of course, this more generally now just depends upon this double commutator with respect to the Hamiltonian, the total Hamiltonian for the subsystem. And this has a decay term that goes to the square of the separation in the energy basis. Now the nice thing about this is that we can easily now quickly calculate how well a clock would behave if this was indeed the equation that was describing its evolution. And you would discover that there was some intrinsic dephasing going on in the two-level system that was defining this clock. In actual fact, if you write down the parameter estimation uncertainty principle, you find that the bound on the right-hand side gets worse and worse as time goes on. In other words, these clocks kind of get a little bit frazzled as time goes on. Of course, it could be a very long time because this parameter gamma is extremely big. Now, you can immediately make that Lorentz invariant just by asking, well, we now want to talk about translations in space-time, so we need an energy momentum 4 vector to generate that. We now go to a field theory and we write the energy momentum 4 vector in terms of the relevant quantum operators for the field. In this case, the electromagnetic field, it just turns out to be photon number, which translates the thing both in space and time, because both time and space translations are ultimately only phase for the electromagnetic field. And you get a similar kind of expression, but now for space-time translations. And we can actually back out some experimental consequences of that for the electromagnetic field. So if we specify the average value of the electric field on some space-like hypersurface in terms of some coherent amplitude, it has to have some coherent amplitude if we're going to see a dispersion relation. So there's the average value of this field. It looks like just some sort of semi-classical field where the average of a particular Fourier component is alpha k. And now you evolve that forward in time, including this intrinsic decoherence effect, and you find that two things happen. One is that there's an overall decay of the amplitude with time, as well as some rotation. And you can estimate what they are. If gamma is very, very big, the decay term, the decay of coherence goes like this, and the frequency term will look, the first order term will look exactly like what it should look like for the electromagnetic field, but now we'll get a correction to that dispersion relation, which goes as 1 over gamma squared, where gamma is this parameter telling us something about the how good the relational clock actually is. So let me finish there by summarizing. This relational time will necessarily lead to some sort of decoherence mechanism in all the systems that are referenced to it. This leads to equations which give intrinsic decoherence, all right, but they still conserve energy and momentum. So unlike in the GRW model where energy is not conserved, in these systems, energy and momentum is conserved. In fact, in the relativistic approach, it's fully Lorentz covariant, at least for the case of displacements. It leads to modified uncertainty constraints, and it also leads to modified dispersion relations, which possibly could be tested somehow, although I really don't have a good idea of how one might actually go about doing that. Thank you very much. Right. Yep. Yes, I've at the moment there are no good experimental constraints on gamma. You can get different dispersion relations depending on the kind of relational clock that you actually put in. The best constraints I can come up with are those based on the very best clocks we have at the moment. And certainly there's no evidence for this intrinsic dephasing in those clocks, which are already working at a precision of about 1 part in 10 to the 16. So at the moment, there's no obvious experimental constraint on what gamma should be. Of course, it's possible that it is in fact so large that we'll never see these effects, in which case we never really have to worry about this intrinsic dephasing mechanism. We just have to put up with all the other realistic, dirty dephasing mechanisms that we have to deal with in the lab every day. But the actual dependence on K that you get depends upon the kind of relational model that you actually start with. Ultimately, you'd want to build one out of some more fundamental theory about quantum gravity, and then it would have some rational basis. That's true. At the moment, I don't have any model that gives that at this level of description. Is it just that I'm occupying? Yeah, sure. Yeah, okay. Oh, yours is a PDF as well. Don't spill your drink on there.